Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we unpack complex ideas and extract the most important insights from a stack of sources. Today, we're taking a deep dive into some truly thought-provoking perspectives on Europe, its economic power, and, well, the pivotal role of institutions in its future.
Indeed. And this particular deep dive, it's based on a fascinating conversation, is between two quite prominent figures.
Who are we talking about?
Johan van Overtveldt. He's an economist, politician for the Belgian NVA, used to be a journalist and editor, and lectures part-time on economic thought at Hasselt University.
Okay, quite a resume.
And Harry Giels, also an economist, and he's the deputy editor-in-chief of Financial Investigator.
Ah, Financial Investigator. So the conversation was published there.
Exactly. A detailed report of their discussion came out in the June edition. It's, you know, a leading platform for institutional investors, so quite influential.
Got it. So it sounds like a really rich discussion, covers a lot of ground.
Oh, definitely. It spans everything from, say, the future of the euro, the changing role of central banks, and even gets into the nitty-gritty of political accountability.
Okay, so as we explore these insights, particularly Van Overtveldt's views from this conversation, what's our main goal today? What should you, our listeners, take away?
Well, our mission really is to get a clear handle on Van Overtveldt's views. They're critical, yes, but also deeply considered, I'd say.
Sure.
We want to explore why he believes Europe needs more political integration for the euro to even survive.
Right.
And how he argues the current quite dominant role of central banks might actually be a threat both to democracy and economic stability.
Interesting.
And then there's his broader take on economic governance, accountability across the EU. So yeah, expect some, let's say, clear-eyed analysis and some fresh takes that might challenge how you think about these things.
Okay, let's start with Van Overtveldt himself. He has this really varied background, politics, business, journalism. He sees this mix not as a problem, but actually as an advantage.
That's right. His conviction, and it's quite strong, is that having that diverse experience, whether it's, you know, running a business or being a journalist, lets politicians spot societal trends faster.
How so?
Well, it helps them approach issues from a wider perspective, maybe less stuck in a purely political or ideological frame. He thinks it helps them act more decisively.
Makes sense. But what about conflicts of interest? That's always a concern with people moving between sectors.
He addresses that directly. He's very clear that while diverse experience is valuable, you absolutely need strong regulations to prevent conflicts.
Like what?
For instance, he's adamant that politicians should not vote on topics where they have or recently had outside involvement. He points to things like the entanglement between the U.S. government and big tech is a sort of cautionary tale. You need those safeguards.
Okay. Does he give a concrete example of how his own varied background helped him see something differently in politics? You mentioned Belgium's inflation earlier.
Yes, exactly. He talks about Belgium having noticeably higher inflation than most other EU countries.
Why is that?
It's largely down to their system of automatic wage indexation.
Sure.
So wages rise automatically with inflation.
Okay.
And Van Overtveldt, with his economic and business background, he says he immediately saw the negative hit this would have on competitiveness.
Right, making Belgian companies more expensive relative to others.
Precisely. So he raised it politically, pushed it as a priority. His suggestion is that maybe a career politician, someone without that outside perspective, might have been slower to grasp the impact or perhaps less forceful in tackling it.
So it raises a bigger question then, doesn't it? How do we get more of that real-world experience into politics?
While still managing those potential conflicts of interest effectively, it's a tricky balance.
Definitely. Okay, let's shift focus now from the personal to something huge, the euro. Van Overtveldt wrote a book, The End of the Euro. That title alone is, well, alarming.
It is. And his argument in it and in this discussion with Giels is pretty stark. He believes that without more political integration, a major crisis is basically inevitable.
And that crisis could lead to the euro's demise.
That's his forecast, yes. It's a bold statement, no doubt about it. For him, political union isn't just some nice-to-have ideal.
It's a necessity for survival.
It's an absolute necessity for the euro to continue. He looks at things like the current debates around European defense.
Yeah.
You know, the talk about a European army.
Yeah, that's gaining traction.
He sees that as maybe a potential step, however slow, towards that deeper integration he thinks is vital. He's quite blunt that just having individual armies for each member state without real coordination is just, well, unwise in today's world.
And he connects this to the wider geopolitical picture, right?
Yeah.
The U.S. may be pulling back, China's rise, Russia being aggressive.
Exactly. He really emphasizes that Europe must become militarily self-reliant. We can't, he argues, stay dependent on others.
Like the U.S. defense umbrella.
Or even, he points out, relying on commercial players like Elon Musk's SpaceX for critical capabilities. That kind of dependency, he feels, is a strategic vulnerability. It leaves Europe's fate in someone else's hands.
Makes sense. But building up that capacity costs a fortune. Is he worried about public spending?
Very much so. He cautions strongly against just throwing money at the problem, against reckless spending. He thinks the defense market itself, if it's funded locally and smartly supported, can offer solutions.
What about joint financing like Eurobonds? That's always controversial.
He acknowledges the resistance, definitely. Countries like the Netherlands, for instance, are historically wary. But ultimately, he argues there isn't really a viable alternative if Europe wants to stay globally competitive and strategically independent.
So doing nothing isn't an option in his view.
No. And he's very explicit. Going back to a sort of Thatcherite model, you know, a loose economic union focused purely on the market with minimal political ties that's just not attractive or workable for Europe now.
Okay, this leads us to another area where he's quite critical. Central banks. He explored this in his book, The Chicago School. Why does he see their expanding role as problematic? Many see them as stabilizers.
Well, his key insight, or argument rather, is that current central bank policies have, maybe unintentionally, allowed politicians to kick the can down the road.
How so?
They delay making tough, necessary economic choices. He specifically points to that famous phrase, whatever it takes, used during the euro crisis.
Right, Draghi's line, meant to reassure markets.
Exactly. But Van Overdveld argues it's been, let's say, politically abused, governments kept spending, avoided fiscal discipline, because they essentially expected the central bank to always be there with a safety net.
So the banks enabled bad behavior, in his view.
That's the implication. He sees central banks becoming overly dominant, and that dominance has had these significant unintended consequences.
And this ties into his latest book, The Icarus Curse, How Western Democracies Derailed and How to Get Back on Track. He links today's sort of societal unease to the misuse of Keynesian economics. Can you unpack that?
Yes, this is really central to his Icarus Curse idea. It raises this crucial question about how economic theory gets applied or misapplied in the real world. Van Overdveld argues that Western democracies are suffering from policy exhaustion. Governments use Keynesian ideas to spend during recessions, deficit spending, to boost demand, the standard stuff.
Right, that's the theory.
But, and this is his critical point, they fail to do the other half. Scale back spending, pay down debt, when times are good.
So they only use the spend part, not the save part.
Precisely. And this constant reliance on policy stimulus without the counter-cyclical discipline has led to, in his words, recklessness, even a kind of decadence in fiscal policy.
And the Icarus curse is flying too close to the sun of debt.
Sort of, yes. Yeah. The idea is that this approach has exhausted our capacity to act. He advocates for societies to align much more with free market principles, something he also pushes in his book, Save the Free Market.
Would Keynes himself agree with how his theories are used?
Van Overdveld argues Keynes would be dismayed. He even cites a specific conference where Keynes apparently admitted that applying his theory continuously without fiscal discipline was unsustainable. He said it would lead to inflation, instability, and even praised Adam Smith.
Wow. So Keynes himself saw the danger.
According to Van Overdveld, yes. He finds it remarkable that political practice keeps going down a road that the theory's originator seemingly rejected for long-term use.
So this policy exhaustion means when a real crisis hits, like the need for rearmament now,
there's no fiscal space left. Governments are broke, essentially. So they resort to what he calls tricks.
Like suspending the Stability and Growth Pact, the EU's own budget rules.
Exactly. Or issuing things like Eurobonds, which blur fiscal responsibility. But it's interesting, while he's critical, he isn't arguing for a completely hands-off approach either. He differs from someone like Milton Friedman on the role of central banks.
How so? Friedman wanted a very minimal role, right? Almost automatic.
Very minimal. Just manage steady money supply growth, basically. Van Overdveld, while critical of the overreach, still sees a legitimate, though limited, role for central banks in financial stability and monetary policy.
So it's not their existence he objects to, but their current expanded mandate.
Precisely. He thinks that expanded mandate is what enables government spending problems and delays needed reforms. He wants balance, not abolition. And building on that idea of how economic theories get twisted, Van Overtveldt also talks about thinkers like Adam Smith and Joseph Schumpeter.
How are they misrepresented, in his view?
Well, take Adam Smith. Everyone knows The Wealth of Nations, The Invisible Hand. But Van Overtveldt points out Smith had a much broader view. He saw a role for government in things like education. And he wrote extensively about the ethics of business in The Theory of Moral Sentiments.
Right. The book focused on empathy and morality.
Exactly. Van Overtveldt suggests Smith might have even considered that book more important than his economic one. But we often just reduce him to the free market caricature. He tries to bring out these nuances in his lectures.
And Schumpeter, the creative destruction guy.
Yes. Van Overtveldt notes that creative destruction, the idea that innovation inherently destroys old industries and jobs, has become almost taboo, especially in Europe. We don't like talking about it.
Why is that significant? What's the implication for Europe versus the U.S., say?
Well, if we connect the dots, he argues that Europe's drive to eliminate all risk, while understandable from a social perspective, ends up stifling the very innovation and resilience we need.
It makes us less dynamic.
That's his argument. He contrasts it with the U.S., which he sees as more built on, let's say, best of the best principles, more accepting of that creative destruction process.
So an American losing a job might pivot faster.
That's his observation. Maybe they take more immediate initiative, retrain, start something new. Whereas in Europe, the first instinct is often to look to the state for support. Now, the European approach provides crucial social safety nets, which is humane and important.
But the trade-off might be lagging behind.
He believes that's partly why Europe lags in areas like tech, communication, maybe even defense, raises that big question. How do you balance social protection with fostering dynamism and innovation?
He also had some pretty strong words about recent U.S. policy ideas, didn't he? Something about U.S. government bonds.
Oh, yes. He didn't mince words there. He called plans like potentially converting existing U.S. bonds into perpetual low-interest ones downright dangerous.
Perpetual bonds, so they never mature.
Yeah, effectively, yes, paying a very low rate forever. He actually coined a term for this kind of thinking, wackonomics.
Wackonomics.
Yeah, his label for economically unsound policies that he thinks threaten global financial stability. His point is that U.S. treasuries are like a bedrock of the global financial system.
So messing with them undermines confidence everywhere.
That's his fear. He sees it as a really poor policy choice, going too far, too fast, and bound to cause confusion and resistance in the markets.
Okay, let's turn to his current role. As chair of the EU Budget Committee, he's been quite outspoken about spending accountability, hasn't he?
Very much so. And he gives specific, concerning examples in his discussion with Giels.
Such as?
He points to 300 complaints currently being investigated by OLF, that's the EU's anti-fraud office.
And these relate to what spending?
Specifically, spending from the huge COVID recovery fund, the Next Generation EU program.
What's the issue there?
He highlights that back in the 2020 summit, when the fund was agreed, member states were basically given oversight over their own spending of these funds.
Self-policing, essentially.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
He says while some control mechanisms were added later, they're just not sufficient in his view. And he fully expects OLF will prove fraud in many of these 300 cases.
Which he calls
a disgrace. Strong word.
And he's worried this lack of accountability could spill over into future funding, like for rearmament.
Absolutely. He sees that scenario funding a massive rearmament effort with the same potentially lax oversight as a massive failure for the EU.
And damaging to public trust.
Hugely. A slap in the face to its citizens, as he put it. He sounds genuinely uncomfortable in his role, seeing the need for much tighter controls, not just for the recovery fund, but also for things like agricultural subsidies, which have always been prone to issues.
He must know these cases fuel Euroscepticism.
Oh, he's acutely aware. He acknowledges these fraud cases play right into the hands of EU critics.
So, given all these criticisms, the economic risks, the accountability problems, does he still actually believe in the EU project overall?
He does, interestingly. He explicitly states he still believes the benefits of EU membership, on balance, outweigh the downsides for the countries involved.
It's a but coming?
There is. He immediately adds a major caveat. He feels the balance is slowly, steadily tipping the wrong way.
And not just because of fraud.
No. He stresses it's also due to what he sees as unnecessary, burdensome bureaucratic regulation.
Does he give an example?
He cites the Green Deal, spearheaded by Frans Timmermans. Now, he acknowledges the intentions are good.
But the execution?
In his view, it's arguably done more harm than good. He thinks it's placed a disproportionate burden on the European economy and, crucially, crowded out other vital priorities.
Like what? Like focusing on prosperity, driving innovation, maintaining sound public finances. So for him, it's an example of a policy where the costs and unintended consequences might be outweighing the benefits, contributing to that tipping balance. It's a nuanced but quite urgent warning he's sounding.
Wow. That really was quite the deep dive into Johan van Overfelt's thinking based on that conversation. We've covered a lot: economic theory, political leadership, the euro, accountability.
It really has. And it just highlights how interconnected all these complex issues are, doesn't it? Global, European. Van Overfelt offers this compelling, sometimes quite challenging perspective.
Yeah, the need for real-world experience in politics, the stark choices facing the euro, the dangers of misapplied economic ideas.
And that critical issue of overseeing public funds properly. It really does pose significant threats to democratic stability if we get it wrong.
His views definitely push you to think hard about how we apply historical economic ideas today, and maybe the hidden dangers of relying too heavily on central banks.
Right. And as you, the listener, reflect on all this, maybe consider Van Overtveldt's final, quite sobering message. The EU still has benefits, yes, but that balance might be tipping.
What's it going to take for Europe to shore up that balance, to make sure it really serves its citizens and stays competitive, resilient on the world stage? That's the lingering question, isn't it?
It really is. And just as a final note, if you found this discussion interesting, Van Overfelt mentioned he does plan to write a follow-up to his book on the Chicago School sometime in the future.
Oh, interesting.
But he also mentioned eventually wanting to retire, spend more time with family. It's just a reminder, I suppose, that even people deeply involved in shaping policy are also thinking about that balance between professional life and personal well-being.
A good reminder. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it's given you plenty to chew on and perhaps a fresh perspective on the economic and political currents shaping Europe and really the wider world.